GEICO gives you more coverage, combining all your car coverage needs, from flats to fender benders to dead batteries to towing. It's a total car coverage combination, kind of like a combination of Ranchera, 8-bit video game music, and a high school choir on helium. Hey, I'd stream that song. Whatever you need, from coverage to service, get more with GEICO.
Fresh Florida blueberries. In a world of jumbo-sized snacks and artificial flavors, Florida blueberries stand proud, bursting with antioxidants and ready to tackle hunger, one delectable bite at a time. From muffins to smoothies or straight out of the carton, they are the tiny titans of taste, delivering freshness as bold as they are blue, proving once again that good things come in small packages. To see what Florida blueberries can do for you, visit freshfromflorida.com today.
There's only one place where go-go beats pulse through the streets, where you can visit the only national museum dedicated exclusively to African-American life, history, and culture. There's only one DC. Visit Washington.org to plan your trip.
The best AI assistant isn't one that knows the whole world. It's one that knows your world. A custom assistant built on Watson X with IBM's Granite models can leverage your trusted data, be easily trained on your workflows, and integrate with your apps. It can be tuned to do just what you need, because the more AI knows about your world, the more it can help you do. Learn more at ibm.com/productivity. IBM. Let's create.
This is an iHeart Original.
On March 13th, 1986, a couple burst out of a taxi in Vienna. In front of them, the U.S. Embassy. Only a few dozen feet stand between them and their freedom. When they hastily push open the car door, they don't bother to close it behind them. Every second counts. A white taxi had been tailing them the whole ride. Inside the taxi are their bodyguards. Bodyguards they have just escaped from. The couple sprints across the pavement and hops up the few stairs to the embassy. If a bystander were to hit pause, freeze frame, and zoom in on the couple, their arms outstretched, ready to open the heavy doors, sweat clinging to their foreheads and upper lips, they might recognize them. This is Shin Sang-ok, a famous South Korean film director, and his wife, the award-winning actress Choi Yoon-hee. Here on the steps of the United States Embassy, they are moments away from catching their biggest break yet. For the last several years, the couple has been in the claws of the North Korean government. Today, they're making a break for it. Their life has been so bizarre, it could be mistaken for an action movie plot. A little too on the nose for the likes of Shin and Choi. Their story involves kidnapping, love affairs, and friendships with unstable dictators. But before we press play and see if they pass through the embassy doors, we need to rewind and watch the strange series of events that led two of the most influential figures in cinema to become personal hostages of Kim Jong-il. Welcome back to Very Special Episodes, an iHeart Original podcast. I'm your host, Dana Schwartz, and this is North by North Korea.
Thank you for joining us. I'm joined by Dana Schwartz.
Hey.
Zarin Burnett. I'm Jason English. I kept thinking as we were reading drafts of this one that if we were writing depraved Kim Jong-il fan fiction, like this is the kind of crazy stuff that we could only hope to approach.
Oh my God. He is such a mercurial, strange character as the dictator's son, but also as like a just a Hollywood and American lover. You don't see it coming.
It's such an amazing character. This, I will say, is the one very special episode the most where, as I was reading it, I was like, this is a movie.
Oh,
this
yeah.
is incredible. I can't believe yeah. this story was real. I had to like fact check this episode as I was going, where I was like, is Jason doing an April Fool's Day on me? Is this too good?
Yeah. How can this be real? This is the best love story I've never heard.
Yeah. A couple? A love yeah. story?
Are you kidding me?
All right. I don't want to give too much away. Let's get back into it. We'll discuss on the other side.
The first time Shin Sang-ok laid eyes on Choi Yoon-hee, he saw her for who she truly was, an ambitious, creative force. It was 1953, months after the Korean War's armistice. Both countries were still smoldering from bombings and napalm. North Korea was run by a socialist dictatorship. Our story starts in South Korea. Shin was an aspiring director looking for a leading lady for his upcoming film. He'd heard of the talented and popular Madame Choi, so he bought a ticket to see her in a play in a city south of Seoul. In that theater on that unassuming evening, Shin couldn't take his eyes off of her.
Shin grew up in an affluent household. His talents were encouraged by his family. He was seen as a gifted child. He went to some of the best schools, and he was able to study painting and art in Tokyo during the war.
This is Ravi Mangla, a writer and novelist. His most recent book, The Observer, is a fictionalized version of Shin and Choi's story.
And then on the other side, you have Choi, who is a very shy and reserved child. Her talents not encouraged in the same way. And acting was a place where she found solace and where she really came alive. And when she told her parents that she wanted to be an actress, that was not something that they accepted readily. So when she was 17, she actually ran away to join up with a theater troupe. And during the war, she was an entertainer for troops. So both she and Shin ended up in the entertainment industry, but through two very different channels.
As the play unfolded, Shin watched Choi give everything she had on stage until she had nothing left.
Choi, who was suffering from exhaustion at the time, fainted on stage. And as the story goes, Shin rushed up to the stage, picked her up, threw her over his shoulder, and then took her to the nearest hospital.
Shin stayed with Choi throughout her hospital visit. When she was released, Choi told Shin about her struggles, how her husband couldn't work and how poor they were. Shin, having only watched her perform in half a play, felt in his gut that it was his destiny to meet her. So he offered her the role in his upcoming film. He'd pay her as much as he could. According to Paul Fisher's excellent book, A Kim Jong-il Production, which we'll link to in the show notes, Shin started loitering around the theater's back door, waiting for Choi to be done with her play. Shin always called her Madam Choi, a sign of respect. They'd wander the streets, so wrapped up in conversation, they'd miss the mandatory curfew. They snuck around like teenagers, although they were both well into their late 20s. Shin told Madam Choi, "Any film I make, I want you to be in it." Choi filed for divorce and swiftly married Shin on March 7, 1954. They'd known each other for less than a year. Once they joined forces, they were unstoppable. Shin began to build up his studio and cast Choi in nearly every film, right when the South Korean public wanted nothing more than to escape to other worlds.
They're so powerful, I think, as a couple, because Che is the on-screen figure, right? And again, she is so unmistakable. And then Shin is able to take her through all of these really iconic roles that really span across the kind of feminine archetypes that you can think of or you could come up with, right? And so I think that that partnership is so fruitful because you have a screen presence and then a behind the camera presence, and they're kind of in synergy.
That's Michelle Cho, an assistant professor at the University of Toronto. Her focus is on Korean film and culture.
South Korean filmmaking of the early post-war is described as a golden age because there were some really iconic films that were produced during the time that are really sophisticated in terms of the way that they're trying to process the changes that are happening in society.
Shin and Choi worked across genres and grew exponentially.
Shin was also an innovator. He entered films and competitions all around the world. So this was the first time that South Korean film was really getting out onto the international stage, and people were seeing what was being created in South Korea, and they were hearing stories that they had never heard before.
There are some parts of his body of work that, you know, people will compare directly to Hollywood films that he likely adapted a lot of things from. So, you know, he dabbled in the Western. He made a bunch of these family melodramas. He made period pieces. He made war films. He was really kind of a sponge, I think, in terms of picking up influences aesthetically and emotionally from this kind of world cinema culture that was around him.
It's up for debate whether Shin was intentional about creating more political and progressive stories.
A lot of Shin's films, especially during the Golden Age, were enlightenment films, quote unquote.
One obvious example is Shin and Choi's 1961 film, The Evergreen Tree, about an educated couple who tries to instill modern schooling in a small rural town. They become local heroes as they also fight against the colonialist Japanese government trying to undo their teachings.
And so that has a very specific meaning in post-colonial Korea, where it's kind of a storytelling mode that talks about the modernization of a person, whether that's through a transformative encounter with like an inspiring teacher or a learning experience of a youth that then kind of forces them to look at the world in a new way. This enlightenment mode is really intended to teach the public how to think of themselves as new national subjects and as new, like, modern subjects. So what are modern ways of thinking? Rationality, you know, a pursuit of learning, a kind of desire to remake yourself as, like, a civilized human being in this very, like, progressive mode.
These stories helped Korean audiences process not only their violent past, but a hopeful future. And the films were a hit.
They received quite a lot of acclaim at the time, but they were extremely prolific during that period, producing over 200 films, and Shin himself directed over 70 films.
Shin Films is really responsible for the popularization of cinema as like a core aspect of popular culture in South Korea. It was such a strong and dominant source of films, and it defined the film culture.
But Shin's films wouldn't have been nearly half as good without his better half. Choi was more than a muse. She was Shin's creative equal.
She is an unmistakably iconic screen presence. Shin casts her in a couple of his most iconic films of the 50s. I have thought quite a lot about how it's the case that Choi and he was so respected, despite the fact that she played characters who are representative of the most kind of denigrated groups of people in South Korea.
Choi took on every kind of role imaginable, from a confident sex worker to a chaste and dutiful widow.
So it's this constant struggle to try and reshape attitudes around gender, which is part of what makes Choi such a remarkable figure. I have to think that the fact of her marriage to Shin was part of what protected her, I think. Because even if she played characters on screen who lacked legitimacy, she, in real life, had the legitimacy of this very powerful figure in the film industry.
According to Paul Fisher's book, Choi was paid the highest fees of any other actress, and even more than Shin, making Choi the breadwinner in their house. Their whole life revolved around their films. They even optimized their home for work. They had a room where they set up an editing bed and a large projector to sit side by side and edit each movie together. At the height of Shin Studios, they employed over 300 people and produced 30 films a year. Choi also started an acting school and mentored younger actors. Part of their success came from Shin's refusal to let anything get in the way of his vision. A contemporary said Shin would have jumped down to hell to make a film. By the early 60s, Shin Studios was at its height. They had it all. Well, almost.
There is a story that Choi said that she wanted to have children, and Shin said, "Why do we need children? Our films are our children," which gives you a look into how single-minded he often was about filmmaking.
But Choi wanted more. When she had a hard time getting pregnant, they decided to adopt. Now they really had it all. Stratospheric careers, fame, prestige, and a family. Their names were always mentioned in the same breath. Every day, Shin got to peer through the camera lens and look at his two loves at once, Choi and movies. Life was picture perfect until someone of great importance took notice of them. Over the border, North Korean film was going through its own revolution, though under a very different regime. When the 38th parallel was tattooed into maps, North Korea isolated itself from most of the world. The exception was those countries who were bankrolling them to stay afloat, like China and the USSR. North Korea became an authoritarian socialist regime. There was no freedom of speech, movement, or expression. Organized religion was restricted. Kim Il-sung was the first great leader, and everything and everyone served his vision. Neighbors were encouraged to spy on one another, and history was rewritten in the regime's favor. No one was allowed to question their leader. Small infractions could be interpreted as an act against the state, resulting in relocation to the countryside. Image was everything, and Kim Il-sung knew that.
So North Korean culture at the time embraced an extreme level of conformity. People had a strong sense of duty to Kim's father and figures of authority, and they valued the collective over the individual. And that was really reflected in all of the art and cinema and materials being created at the time. Propaganda was being created to enhance the reputation of the government and earn loyalty from the populace. So North Korean citizens at the time were restricted from consuming Western media. And the latest films at the time were not accessible to North Korean residents.
All films were under state control. And film is the ideal medium for propaganda. It's easy to tell a message on a mass scale where everyone watches together and can watch each other.
From the beginning, the leadership in North Korea understands the power of this medium and so wants to be able to harness it for the sake of educating the public, of instilling in the public a better understanding of what the guiding ideology of the North Korean state is and what it should be. That's the distinctive feature of mass culture in a socialist country. And so it's entertainment, yes. It's showing ways for the populace to be kind of modern and to think of themselves as new national subjects after liberation or after the Korean War. But fundamentally, it's there to serve as an ideological vehicle.
All films were structured around the North Korean philosophy of Juche.
So the North Korean state ideology is called Juche ideology, and it is translated as self-reliance. I think of it as a kind of paradox or tension at the core of Juche ideology, in the sense that it is placing responsibility for maintaining a kind of collective vision in the individual hands of each member of society. And so it does this really interesting thing of balancing out the individual and collective.
Juche bristles at the thought of asking for help. It states that every individual should hold their own, and every action they take is for the collective good of North Korea alone. If the collective relies on each other, they don't need outsiders and can avoid being dependent on countries like they had been in the past.
But it was also a way for North Korea to also keep itself independent or distinguishable from the Maoist communist China and the Soviets, and not get overshadowed by larger nation states that seek to incorporate the North into whatever their agenda might be. And I think that comes directly out of the experience of colonial occupation under Japan. And that also shapes the way that North Korea sees what South Korea is, which is as a puppet colony of the United States.
Because all films were created through the lens of Juche, all of the films had nearly identical plots.
The dominant structure of North Korean films is this kind of trajectory of some individual person going through hardship, either because of a class struggle, you know, or because of some kind of injustice that they experience, and then coming to realize through that suffering that the principles of Juche and the stewardship of the dear leader are what offer some kind of hope.
So a defector of North Korea had said that you didn't even have to stay for the second half of a North Korean film because you knew what was going to happen. There was no surprise.
Although these movies objectively were boring and poorly made, there was one person who was obsessed with film. Kim Il-sung's eldest son, Kim Jong-il.
He is widely known to be a film buff with a huge collection of films in a private collection that he gets to access, because most North Koreans do not get to see films from the West.
Although Kim Jong-il was raised in extreme wealth and power, his childhood wasn't a happy one.
So Kim Jong-il had a lonely upbringing by all accounts. The people he played with or was allowed to socialize with was extremely limited, and he found solace in film. Film was something he fell in love with.
So he submerged himself in films. He started a bootlegging and smuggling ring to bring international films into the country. He had American prisoners of war translate and voice American films. He created his own massive secret cinema lair, air-conditioned and fully staffed with 250 people, all for an audience of one.
And as he got older, he amassed a collection of more than 20,000 films. He was known as a huge fan of Elizabeth Taylor. He loved the James Bond franchise.
Kim Jong-il would rather watch movies all day than partake in mandatory military service. He also had a bad temperament and lashed out at people. Kim Jong-il wasn't qualified to inherit the country. Kim Il-sung couldn't place his artsy, antagonistic son until a perfect situation fell into his lap. One film was made, some sources say it was a play, that risked challenging Kim Il-sung's personality cult. It was interpreted as treason. The creators were sent to the mountains, and Kim Il-sung stormed into the studio office to lecture the remaining studio executives. After his tirade, Kim Il-sung asked the room if anyone had the courage to lead the propaganda and agitation department in accordance with the party's ideologies and rules. Standing behind nearly everyone in the back, Kim Jong-il raised his hand.
In this informal role of propaganda minister, he was allowed to lean into his love of film craft. At the same time, he was being carefully trained to take on a leadership role at a time that his father stepped aside. So in a way, it was a win-win for both Kim and for his father.
Once Kim Jong-il took the reins of the film industry, he thrived by North Korean standards.
He even wrote a book of film criticism in 1973 called On the Art of Cinema. And this was not just a thin 50-page book. We are talking about a 400-page tome. And in that book, he talked about how all film should be imbued with an ideology. It advocated for film as propaganda.
Kim Il-sung loved the films his son oversaw. But Kim Jong-il knew something his father didn't. These films were bad. Although citizens were told that North Korean film was the best in the world and leading the film industry, Kim Jong-il had watched enough foreign films to know that his movies were not up to snuff. Kim Il-sung also wanted North Korean film to be internationally recognized so the world could one day know that North Korea is superior to every other country. But even South Korean cinema was outpacing them, and he had to do something.
Kim Jong-il felt that the only way that he could fix the North Korean film industry was with better talent. And he saw Shin Sang-ok and Choi Yoon-hee in South Korea, and he wanted that for his country. He wanted it in such a literal way, he was willing to go to extreme lengths to get it.
There's only one place where Go-Go Beats post through the streets, where you can visit the only national museum dedicated exclusively to African-American life, history, and culture. There's only one DC. Visit Washington.org to plan your trip.
Finals, the most fear-inducing word in a college student's vocabulary. And as finals approach, a little extra help can make a huge difference. So from now through May, ChatGPT Plus is free for students, with everything from quizzing you using your class notes to giving you ideas on how to land a summer internship, ChatGPT's got you. Maybe you're a visual learner and you need ChatGPT to describe Keynesian economics for you with charts and graphs and pictures. Or you just really need a meal plan you can follow for now and then a workout plan you can follow after finals. ChatGPT's got you there too. If you can think of a problem, ChatGPT can help you solve it. If you have a situation where you need a little guidance, ChatGPT can help you find the way. And from now through May, ChatGPT Plus is free for college students. That means you have no limits on how many amazing ways you can ask ChatGPT to help you. ChatGPT Plus, free for college students through May. Restrictions apply.
Despite the meteoric success of Shin Studios, Shin and Choi made movies during a time of increased censorship and authoritarian rule by the South Korean government. But Shin did what he had to do not to let anything get in the way of his films.
Shin and Choi were able to rub shoulders with the country's cultural and political elite. They had a good relationship at the time with General Park.
The current leader of South Korea was General Park, who had seized power via coup in 1961. Park wanted to show the world that South Koreans embraced modernism and were culturally sophisticated, not like those tyrant socialists in the North. General Park and his wife also had a close personal relationship with Shin and Choi.
And for that reason, he allowed Shin and Choi with a great deal of artistic license, at least in the early going, because he wanted South Korea to be recognized on the international stage. He wanted that cultural recognition from the Western world.
In the 1970s, tensions rose between North and South Korea. General Park became more authoritarian. He started limiting the rights and freedoms of South Koreans.
So from 1972 onwards,
kind of shows this censorship regime growing and kind of being much more involved in trying to, well, first take out anything that could potentially be perceived as political viewpoints. The guiding principle to all of his initiatives and the way that he's able to convince the Korean public to go along with it is this anti-communist stance, that everything that he's doing to restrict the liberties and freedoms of South Koreans is absolutely necessary in order to fend off the threat of North Korea. But my sense is that Shin made some of his best films in South Korea and kind of experienced a lot of growth and really reached the peak of his career when he had a pretty friendly relationship with the government. There's a sense that, you know, Shin Films and Shin Studios was getting along really well with the Park Chung-hee administration until it didn't.
Now, South Korea was becoming as tight-lipped as its estranged brother to the North, especially in the arts.
Park's regime became much stricter around ideas in film and music and art. And there were extremely rigid censorship boards that would review films over and over again to make sure that the content was nothing that could be seen as controversial or out of step with South Korea and the South Korean government at the time.
So anything that could be even in the slightest way interpreted as criticism of the government is a no-go, clearly. He is really interested in policing, you know, what people see in film and television.
Regardless of politics, Shin always managed to use his political connections to get his movies made, no matter the content. Shin began to believe that he was above the rules. He continued to follow his artistic inclinations, even if they went against the censorship laws. Every other time he'd broken the rules, he would just go and chat with his government friends. But times were changing.
In a screening of a film, a new film, Shin had refused to take out a romantic scene, so a scene where characters kiss. And that so angered the censorship office that Shin Films like finally loses favor with the Park Chung-hee administration.
This time, Shin's justifications fell on deaf ears at the censorship bureau. He was also stripped of his film license. That wasn't all he lost during this time.
About this time, the time that Shin Studios was beginning to decline and running into struggles with the censorship boards, was also the time that Shin and Choi's relationship was facing a lot of difficulties and friction. So in the early 1970s, Shin struck up an affair with a younger actress, and this became a public scandal.
Up until now, Choi had always looked the other way when Shin had dalliances with other women. They were usually flings, nothing serious. But this time was different. One morning, home alone, Choi picked up a film magazine and saw her husband's name in a headline. Ice ran through her veins as she scanned through the article. According to the news, Shin had just become a father. He had had an affair with a much younger actress, and she gave birth to Shin's son. Affairs were one thing, but a love child? When Shin knew Choi was crestfallen that she couldn't give birth on her own, they tried to make it work, but then the actress gave birth to a second child. This was unforgivable, and Choi separated from Shin. Now Shin had no wife, no career, no studio, no art to make. The whole life he'd built began to unspool like a film reel tumbling to the ground. Due to the decline of Shin Studios, Choi's acting studio and career took a hit too. Life faded from Technicolor to black and white for both of them. Time went by, it looked like there was no way for this former powerhouse to regain their relationship or creative status. Until one unsuspecting day in 1977, Choi received a curious visitor. A Hong Kong businessman asked if she would be interested in directing a film in China. It was a strange request, but Choi needed a break from South Korea. Choi packed a bag and flew to Hong Kong, where the Chinese businessmen wined and dined her. When she tried to mention the film, the men changed the subject. This unnerved her. On her penultimate morning, men with sloppy long hair put a bag over her head and threw her into a boat.
She described being held in the hull of a cargo ship and feeling incredible fear. She had no idea what was going on, but had been coerced onto this boat and now does not know what the future holds, what is in front of her, what is happening.
For 6 days, Choi felt unmoored as the waves undulated beneath her. She barely ate. When the boat anchored, she was transferred to a smaller vessel. Choi was brought up on deck and then brought on shore a little ways away from the main port, still wearing the same outfit she was kidnapped in. A man in a large coat approached her with a huge smile.
"Thank you for coming, Madam Choi. You must be exhausted. Welcome. I am Kim Jong-il."
Choi musters the strength to not faint. The North Korean dictator's son is standing before her, talking to her by her name. People in North Korea hadn't even heard Kim Jong-il's voice yet. Someone whipped out a camera and took a photo. Choi tried to hide. The camera clicked. In the photo is the large, smiling silhouette of Kim Jong-il. Madam Choi, after a life of having her picture taken, buried her chin and nose into her scarf. The rest of her face is hidden under large sunglasses.
So it's a bit of a whirlwind for Choi once she arrives in North Korea. She is brought to luxury accommodations.
Choi is taken to a villa, which is really a tacky yet glamorous house arrest. Her handlers walked her under gaudy chandeliers to her new room. Her passport and South Korean identity card are taken. Her new bedroom is filled with clothing tailored to her body, along with makeup she used to use. They had been expecting her. When she went to shut the door, she noticed the doors didn't lock. She will soon find that none of them do inside this prison palace. Her days are no longer her own and are structured around her, quote, re-education.
She's introduced to a private tutor who immediately begins talking to her about the life and achievements of Kim Il-sung. She's isolated and bored and being held in these luxury accommodations for reasons that she doesn't understand. She doesn't know why she has been brought to this country, what they want of her, but she's almost like an animal in a cage, just being paraded around and has no autonomy of her own.
During her re-education, Choi learns fast not to question what she's taught about North Korea, no matter how fanciful and highly unlikely. Now, in the belly of the beast, Choi must do her best acting yet. There's a phone in her room where Kim Jong-il has a private phone line for just Choi. He frequently calls her up asking if she's doing anything, like it's a genuine question.
Kim Jong-il is very excited by the arrival of Choi. He has been isolated his whole life in his love of cinema. And in Choi, he has somebody who he respects. He respects her opinion. He wants to know her thoughts and perspectives on art and entertainment. This seems a very one-sided relationship that Kim has almost forced somebody to be his friend. He has the friend that he always wanted.
At times, Kim Jong-il calls her Teacher Choi, given that she was well into her 50s by now.
So Choi's behavior at the time is heavily watched over, and she has people instructing her on how to behave and act. She does not have a lot of freedom to do the things she wants, to say the things she wants. She has been taught to be totally obedient at this time. So while Kim admires her opinions and wants her perspectives on things, in a larger sense, she's extremely limited in what she can say and do.
As Choi spent more time with Kim, she saw that he had all the trappings of a dictator's son. He had lavish parties surrounded by yes men and women. Choi was invited to the parties often, as if she had an option to decline.
So he loved parading Choi around as arm candy, as a prize or a trophy that he had acquired.
Choi's disappearance didn't go unnoticed in South Korea. Shin had known she was going to Hong Kong and was growing concerned he hadn't heard from her. So he called a friend and was told to go there himself. When he arrived in Hong Kong, he learned about her disappearance and that all of her luggage was left in her hotel room, which gave the impression she would return.
This was not somebody who had escaped. So Shin believed that she had been kidnapped or something awful had happened. And keep in mind, they had children. They had children who were wondering where their mother was.
Shin had to go to the United States for a spell, but returned to Hong Kong to investigate. And unfortunately, he met a similar fate.
Shin came to Hong Kong, and he ended up being betrayed by a friend who is an agent for the North Korean government.
His kidnapping was a repeat of his wife's. His days were broken up into hours of ideological training, lunch, and a nap. The latter half of his day was spent watching North Korean films that Kim Jong-il specifically requested he watch, for some reason. The films were so bad, Shin preferred the ideological training. Unlike Choi, who used her acting chops to survive, Shin only knew action. He was not used to someone else directing his life. He tried to escape twice. When he was recaptured the second time, the North Koreans threw him in a packed detention center.
He was kept in that detention center for over 3 years, where he was in a cell so small he could barely lie down. He was forced to undergo extreme re-education, and he lost a great deal of weight. His health suffered quite a bit during that time.
With nothing to do, all Shin could do was think. He relived and rewatched every mistake he had ever made in his life. His affairs, his children, his career, and hurting Choi. And mixed in this stew of regret, he began to mentally re-edit all of his films. As he stared at the same spot in his cell every day, he redirected his movies in his head, played them on repeat, reshoot, retrimmed and reorganized each one to have a stronger impact. If only he could get one more chance. Then, one day, after years of living in a deplorable detention center, Shin was released and told to get ready to meet the dictator's son. Over the same 3 years, only the seasons changed for Choi. When she asked to be reunited with her family, she was told she would see them once the two Koreas reunite. As the world continued to spin around the sun, she quietly celebrated each of her children's birthdays to herself. She often went into her bathroom and turned on the faucet so no one could hear her weeping. Her days were spent writing long, congratulatory letters to both Kim Jong-il and his father, thanking them for showing her the light and superior ways of North Korea. In the moments when she put down her pen, she continued to rack her brain as to why she was here. One unsuspecting night, she's invited to another one of Kim's lavish parties. When she arrives, she notices that there's something extra about this party. There are more people, more food, louder music. And everyone is congratulating her for reasons she doesn't understand. In all of the merriment, the guest of honor walks in. The music stopped. A woman grabbed Choi by the arm and began to bring her over to the guest of honor, a thin and frail man. Choi's heart drops to her stomach. It takes her a moment to recognize him, but she knew this man. She knew him very well.
That's the first time that they are seeing each other in about 5 years. So it's hard to imagine just the shock of seeing a ghost, someone that you weren't sure was alive, that you had no idea where they were, and somebody who you had built a life with. They are suddenly appearing in this foreign land at a party by Kim Jong-il. And I think there was a sense of relief to know that one another was all right.
Choi was left standing in front of Shin. The room went quiet. Kim Jong-il looks from one to the other. He tells them to hug each other, for heaven's sake. Why are they both just standing there? Then Choi rests her head on Shin's shoulder, the way she used to, and feels the familiar groove of his collarbone, the safety of his chest. Despite the bankruptcy and the affairs and the love children and now kidnapping, the world falls away, and they hold on to each other for dear life. The room erupts in applause. Kim Jong-il announces that Mr. Shin will be his film advisor. The party continued for hours. When the party was over, they were driven back to another prison palace. They would be living together again, with their handlers, of course. When they arrived, they entered their private bathroom. Choi turned on the faucets, and they tentatively began to recap the last 5 years. At first, Shin was apprehensive of Choi. She seemed to have good relations with the North Koreans while at the party. Then Choi quipped, "Why, the movie director can't even recognize acting when he sees it," and laughed. Regardless of their past, at least they weren't alone anymore. The last thing they discussed, while the water was still running, was outlining not a movie, but an escape. The next morning, Kim Jong-il put them to work.
For 6 months, he had them watch 4 or 5 films a day and critique them. He gave them access to his entire film library, and he engaged them in deep conversations about film and art. So now he has 2 friends, and he is absolutely over the moon.
And Choi and Shin finally learned the real reason they were kidnapped. First, Kim believed making movies would help fund the economy. Despite these opulent parties, the regime was actually in decline. The North Korean economy hadn't bounced back enough to repay the loans they had received from China and the USSR. Kim Jong-il wanted to maintain his lavish lifestyle. Amongst many of his devious plans to boost the economy, Kim Jong-il believed that film revenue from international distribution could be one way. And
Kim Jong-il's goal is to have North Korean cinema recognized on an international scale. And he knows a propaganda film is not going to be what creates that fame and recognition from, you know, from both the East and the West.
Kim Jong-il wanted to be on par with Hollywood and Western films. Choi and Shin were left to square with a leader of a hermit country who wanted international attention. Now, Shin and Choi began the balancing act of outlining scripts and planning their escape. The couple researched and prepared for their films around the country. They had bodyguards with them everywhere they went. And in these tours around the country, Shin and Choi visited a rare department store that sold Western items and managed to purchase a tape recorder. Shin realized he could use it to his advantage. They could record Kim, and get him to admit that he had planned to kidnap them. And that's just what they do, secretly, at a meeting with him. This was obviously incredibly risky behavior. Recording the North Korean party leaders is a death sentence, but the couple can't have the outside world, especially South Korean leaders, thinking they came here willingly. Choi kept the recorder in her bag. She reached down and, as quietly as she could, pressed record as Kim Jong-il began monologuing. He discussed the problems with North Korean films and his knowledge of international films. He also admitted that he plotted to kidnap them without prompting. He thought he could only get to Shin if he captured Choi first. They kept up their appearances, laughing and smiling at Kim's jokes as they recorded. When the meeting finished, Shin and Choi played back the tapes with the faucet running in their bathroom. With this tape, they could prove they didn't defect to North Korea. But in the immediate term, Shin and Choi's first task was to make a movie for Kim Il-sung's birthday, April 15th. It was late October. They had 6 months to go.
What was so fascinating for me is that any act of creation, any book you write or film you make, it is such a deeply personal act. It's an act that requires safe mental, physical, and psychological space. So the idea of creating something under duress, having your life being almost dangled over you while you are making a film, is such a strange and foreign concept that very few people have ever experienced. What is that like? How do you make art that is being coerced?
Under duress or not, Shin couldn't help but feel like himself again when he got behind the camera.
Kim respected Shin and Choi so much that he allowed them a level of creative control that he had never allowed for any North Korean director. He was not micromanaging in the same way, and he trusted their vision. He had seen the way that they had catapulted the South Korean film industry, and he wanted the same thing for North Korea, and he knew that he was not able to helicopter over them in the same way if those were the aspirations that he had. In North Korea, he's given a great deal of license to create what he wants and given all the resources to create it.
Even leaving the country.
Kim's desire for cultural superiority and international recognition is so great that he begins breaking his own rules. So Shin and Choi were allowed to travel internationally, and they were allowed to travel on the communist side of the Iron Curtain. All of this is happening in the climate of the Cold War at the time.
Under Kim Jong-il's request, they set up shop in Eastern Europe and started rolling. Shin had officially jumped down to hell in order to make a film. 6 months later, their first film, Emissary of No Return, delighted Kim Jong-il and global audiences, even winning an international award. Kim Jong-il showered Choi and Shin with gifts and gave them full control over future films.
And that means money is no object. If he wants 1,000 extras, Kim Jong-il will deliver them. He routinely would send members conscripted in the army to serve as extras in Shin's films. He wanted a train to explode in one of his films, so Kim Jong-il delivered a train filled with dynamite. So whatever Shin wanted, whatever Choi wanted, Kim delivered for them.
It's like that scale of production was possible in the North Korean context because he had all of the resources of the government behind him.
Over the next 3 years, Shin and Choi pumped out 6 more films. And in the strangeness of this time, Choi and Shin fell back into a similar rhythm that mirrored their previous life. They began to fall back in love. Their days were filled with writing, editing, coaching, acting, and directing, like in their early days. The North Korean public loved all of their films. With each success, Shin asked for a bigger staff and imported goods from East Germany.
the couple could travel as much as they wanted within the walls of the Iron Block.
So they were able to travel to places like Moscow and Czechoslovakia and enter their films in competitions. Like Kim, Shin and Choi had a lot of cognitive dissonance at this time. They are being granted the freedom that they were yearning for in South Korea. They have the ability to make the films of their dreams.
When Choi and Shin were in Eastern Europe and the USSR, they demonstrated pride in their work, which made the Western world question their whole story about them being kidnapped.
This is also the first time that South Korea is seeing Choi and Shin. They did not know what happened to them or where they went. And this creates a ton of speculation and rumor in South Korea at the time. And what most people believe was that they defected, to North Korea. So now Shin and Choi, formerly leading lights, formerly stars of South Korean cinema, are now persona non grata. They are now widely despised by the South Korean public.
The Western world started doubting their loyalties.
And I think that, yeah, Shin, there are a lot of questions about what his political ideologies actually were and how he really felt about one regime or another. And I think we'll never be able to know that for sure. Yes, it's a kidnapping. Was it a defection? There's not a lot of clarity. So Shin gets to make his big, you know, spectacles. And Kim gets his kind of tool mouthpiece.
Shin and Choi maintained that escape was always in the back of their minds, no matter how gratifying the art process was.
So on one hand, they're very satisfied. On the other hand, they are still captive. They can't see their children. They can't travel to many parts of the world. And they knew that this was not a long-term or sustainable situation.
The height of their fame in North Korea was their monster movie, Paul Gasari, a North Korean ripoff of Godzilla.
This was the most expensive film that North Korea had ever produced. It included thousands of extras and was a huge hit. Kim Jong-il loved it. And due to the success of that, they were able to make a pitch for an even larger film. They wanted to make an epic about Genghis Khan. And they knew that they would need more financing for this. So Kim allowed them to go to Vienna to meet with financiers for this speculative project. And that's where they hatched their escape.
There's only one place where go-go beats pulse through the streets, where you can visit the only national museum dedicated exclusively to African-American life, history, and culture. There's only one DC. Visit Washington.org to plan your trip.
Finals, the most fear-inducing word in a college student's vocabulary. And as finals approach, a little extra help can make a huge difference. So from now through May, ChatGPT Plus is free for students, with everything from quizzing you using your class notes to giving you ideas on how to land a summer internship. ChatGPT's got you. Maybe you're a visual learner and you need ChatGPT to describe Keynesian economics for you with charts and graphs and pictures. Or you just really need a meal plan you can follow for now, and then a workout plan you can follow after finals. ChatGPT's got you there too. If you can think of a problem, ChatGPT can help you solve it. If you have a situation where you need a little guidance, ChatGPT can help you find the way. And from now through May, ChatGPT Plus is free for college students. That means you have no limits on how many amazing ways you can ask ChatGPT to help you. ChatGPT Plus, free for college students through May. Restrictions apply.
In 1986, Shin and Choi cashed in all of their chips. They convinced Kim Jong-il to let them set up their European studio in Vienna. At the time, Austria was explicitly neutral in the contest between East and West, so being in Vienna could give them enough wiggle room to slip under the Iron Curtain altogether. Shin and Choi arrive at their hotel in the city center with their bodyguards. When their bodyguards aren't looking, Shin slips a piece of paper to a hotel employee. It says who they are, that they're kidnapped by the North Koreans, and to please send help from the U.S. Embassy.
Normally, whenever Shin and Choi left the country, they would have guards and minders and people making sure that they didn't escape. But over time, it became a little bit more lax. And they created the pretense or lie of a journalistic interview. So Shin and Choi made up a story about an interview with a journalist, so they were able to gain some privacy from their bodyguards.
Shin then calls an old friend, a Japanese reporter, Inoki, living in Vienna, and tells him to be ready the next day with a car waiting outside their hotel. Shin then tells their bodyguards that they had an interview with a journalist, which could help convince the Western world that they were in North Korea by choice. Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. The next morning, Shin and Choi have the bodyguards over for breakfast in their hotel room to maintain appearances. Then at 12:30, Shin and Choi go outside to meet Inoki. They notice their bodyguards idling outside. Shin spots Inoki standing by a taxi. Shin and Choi, as casually as they can muster, walk down the street at a seemingly normal pace. Then, once they get close to the car, Shin shoves both the reporter and his wife into the taxi, slams the door, and they book it. In the car, Shin tells Inoki they have been kidnapped by the North Koreans and need to make it to the American embassy. As Shin tries to spit out the situation, Choi notices in the rearview mirror that a white taxi is making every turn as they do it. They tell their driver to go around in circles to try to lose the taxi. The taxi's radio speakers come on. The white taxi is calling to ask where they went. Inoki handed their taxi driver wads of cash and told their driver to lie to the other taxi. Tell them they went the other way. They were only a few minutes away from the embassy. Finally, they arrived at the bottom of a hill. There's too much traffic for the taxi to go through, so Choi and Shin jump out of the car and sprint towards the embassy and burst through the doors. The couple pants and sweats and tries to explain who they are. American diplomats escort them outside and bring them to a safe house. When they enter the safe house, Choi cries and falls into her husband's arms. International papers blew up when the news broke about Shin and Choi. In public accounts, the North Koreans claimed that Shin and Choi had come to North Korea voluntarily and were now kidnapped by the South Korean government. Who knows what Kim Jong-il thought after they escaped.
So this is the first time that Shin and Choi can tell their own story. And they are brought to the United States and they are held in protective housing in Virginia for several years.
Now, after decades of making fiction stories and propaganda, all they cared about was telling the truth.
This is a time that they begin writing their memoirs and telling the true story behind their kidnapping. And fortunately for Shin and Choi, they had been recording a lot of their conversations with Kim. There were many people who believed that they had voluntarily defected. And because of this recordings that in many cases, Choi had captured holding the recorder in her purse, they were able to set the record straight.
They eventually moved to Los Angeles, a filmmaker's dream. This was the third time Shin tried to rebuild Shin Studios from scratch, but they couldn't catch a break. Hollywood operated much differently than the film industry in Korea.
They found it much more difficult than they expected. And Shin did have a little bit of success. He directed three films. People may know them as the Three Ninjas franchise. He directed them under the alias of Simon Sheen. So when you look at the credits, it's not Shin Sang-ok on there. But these were small hits. They were low-budget films that had a fair amount of success. But it wasn't what Shin wanted to do. He wanted to make epics. He wanted to make artistic masterpieces. And he was forced to make sequels for children's films. So it was not his ideal situation.
When Shin and Choi talked to Hollywood producers about turning their own lives into a movie, the producers were hesitant to have three Asian leads. In 1999, Shin and Choi returned to South Korea and lived out the rest of their lives together. Looking back, there seemed to be conflicting feelings about their time in North Korea. Although they insisted that they were kidnapped, was it really all that bad?
Shin regarded his time in North Korea as a real artistic flourishing. So the film Runaway, for instance, he considers his masterpiece. He considers a film that he made while in captivity the best film that he had ever made. So he left with a certain measure of reluctance if he could somehow take that artistic freedom, that amount of resources that he had been given in North Korea, and bring that to a place where he could live his life freely. I think that would have been the ideal situation for him.
When they returned to South Korea, they did go through questioning by the government and in the media. People wanted to make sure they hadn't willingly defected. Shin died in 2006, and Choi passed 12 years later. Obituaries written by American and South Korean papers referenced the kidnapping, solidifying the story that they had been abducted. Although they didn't exactly go out with a bang, their wider impacts are still felt in South Korean cinema.
I think that Shin's work and then, you know, his partnership with Chan, the way that they, again, ranged across so many different genres and showed that they could adapt story forms and settings, like in the Manchurian Western, to the Korean context and make really compelling films. It's basically exactly what the South Korean film industry has become famous worldwide for doing. They were ahead of their time. And so I think that his influence, it can't be overstated. It's recognizable everywhere in the South Korean industry and then across the region too. I think Asian cinema is part of that as well.
What a story.
Oh my goodness. Paul Gasari, come on now.
Oh my God, this love story. I can't believe they came together.
and the daring escape. Are you kidding me? The foot chase? Oh, this, you're so right, Dan, up top. This is a movie.
It's like you could see it.
Yeah.
So Zarin, I know you knew this story because you and Elizabeth covered this on Ridiculous Crime. Is there any other color that we had to leave out of this version?
Oh, I would just say the only thing that we fixated on in the story that we kind of didn't cover in this version was the abductors themselves were a funny group, and like nobody could ever get the number right. So it was like, it was like 3 to 4 guys. We just kept laughing about how humans have a hard time counting past 3. You get to like 4, like, I don't know, it's 3 or 4, maybe 5, I don't know. So the idea that these abductors, who, to be pointed out, they both get abducted, but they get abducted in such strange ways, and all of a sudden you show up in North Korea. Like, how bizarre is that as a life moment? Like, so I would say that was the part that we fixated on. But other than that, it's the exact same story, and it's so beautiful that I loved this rendition because we spent more time on the love story.
I love this love story. This made me so happy.
Totally. And by the way, the love story I'm talking about is Kim Jong-il and Paul Gasari, the Godzilla-style monster. That's what I meant.
So. Yeah, that's the real romance of this episode.
Also, by the way, Paul Gasari, I kept noticing, this time I didn't notice it before, sounds a lot like Paul Gasol, the former basketball player. So I kept picturing a Paul Gasol inside the Godzilla-style monster suit. So that was just fun for me.
I knew this story because going way back in the Mental Floss magazine print days, someone had written this as a feature about Kim Jong-il and the filmmakers he kidnapped and the Godzilla movie he always wanted to make, something like that. And I remember the night that Kim Jong-il died, we had a meeting, like frantic phone meeting about like, well, we should put something up about Kim Jong-il. What do we got? And then like, well, I guess this is as good as story as any. Not sure how to talk about a brutal dictator on his death, but this felt like, well, people should know this story. So I'm glad we continue to get this story out to more people in more elaborate ways.
And that is the proper perspective for a dictator, is to kind of poke fun at them.
Any very special characters on either of your radars?
I will do the Godzilla monster.
Oh, yeah. Good call.
The monster itself.
Yeah. And following in that, I picked the filmmaker, but not when he was in either South or North Korea, but when he was in America and known as Simon Sheen, and he directed the Three Ninjas franchise. I had no idea that the director of the Three Ninjas franchise had once been kidnapped by Kim Jong-il. I was like, oh, man, this changes the whole movie.
How about their friend Inoki, the Japanese journalist,
yes,
who just like helps bribe the cab driver? I mean, that guy
got them out.
Yeah.
And the cab driver.
I mean, yes.
The cab driver just going about his day. This jumps into your cab.
All of a sudden, you're an international intrigue. This one was interesting on casting, by the way, because like I had a surprising number of Korean actors that I wanted to cast in this. I thought it was going to be a challenge, but I was like, oh, man, for Kim Il-sung, you got to go with Choi Min-sik from Old Boy, from the Chan-wook Park version of Old Boy, right? He could nail it. And then for Kim Jong-il, the son, I thought, have a little more fun with this. You go Bobby Lee from Mad TV or the co-host of podcast Bad Friends. I thought Bobby Lee would be great. And then for the South Korean director, Shin Song-ok, I was thinking John Cho. He was in Cowboy Bebop. And so I thought he's kind of the cool version of what you want for that. And also he could play a lover. And then for his wife, the South Korean actress, Choi Eun-ji, Kim Yoon-jin, who played Sun on the TV show Lost, if you remember that at all. So I thought she would be great. She has the right vibe. I couldn't not really cast Paul Gasari other than the Paul Gasol inside the suit. So that's all I got.
You know, I love that you pulled John Cho because I'm like, team, put John Cho in more romantic comedies.
Hell yeah. John Cho,
it was in a very short-lived TV show called Selfie that no one watched but me, but it was sort of like a rom-com TV show. And I'm like, this man needs to be a romantic lead. And now that he's like a little older, like make him the director. Let's see that relationship.
I'm so into that call. Also, for a very special character, I also like the U.S. prisoners of war having to do voiceover work and translating the plots of Elizabeth Taylor films. I thought that was just great.
Some good roles for the film version, which definitely now has to happen.
100%.
Very Special Episodes is made by some very special people. Today's episode was written by Adrian Bain and edited by Carmen Borca Carrillo at Wonder Media Network. The show is hosted by Dana Schwartz, Zarin Burnett, and Jason English. Our producer is Josh Fisher. Editing and sound design by Chris Childs. Additional editing by Mary Dew. Mixing and mastering by Chris Childs. Original music by Elise McCoy. Fact-checking by Austin Thompson. Show logo by Lucy Quintanilla. Executive producer is Jason English. If you want to email the show, you can reach us at verispecialepisodes@gmail.com. Very Special Episodes is a production of iHeart Podcast.
And thanks for listening. Could you do us a quick favor? If you're enjoying Very Special Episodes, go subscribe to the show on your favorite podcast platform and give us a rating on Apple or Spotify. It all helps. We'll see you next time.
Fresh Florida blueberries. In a world of jumbo-sized snacks and artificial flavors, Florida blueberries stand proud, bursting with antioxidants and ready to tackle hunger, one delectable bite at a time. From muffins to smoothies or straight out of the carton, they are the tiny titans of taste, delivering freshness as bold as they are blue, proving once again that good things come in small packages. To see what Florida blueberries can do for you, visit freshfromflorida.com today.
There's only one place where go-go beats pulse through the streets, where you can visit the only national museum dedicated exclusively to African-American life, history, and culture. There's only one DC. Visit Washington.org to plan your trip.
Time is running out to change the course of your career in the entertainment industry. AMDA and iHeartRadio Broadway present the Ultimate Talent Competition, your chance to win a full tuition scholarship to AMDA College of the Performing Arts and perform live in the heart of New York City at Broadway in Bryant Park this July. Whether you're a singer, dancer, or actor, if you've got the passion, the skill, and the drive, this is your shot to be seen, to be celebrated, and to start your future in the performing arts. But the deadline is closing fast. Submit your audition tape today at iHeartAMDA.com. That's iHeartAMDA.com. The spotlight is waiting. Step into it. Don't have your video ready yet? Fill out your information on iHeartAMDA.com and we'll be sure to remind you of the May deadline. No purchase necessary. U.S. residents only. Must be a high school student or current AMDA student age 13 or older. Entrant must follow AMDA on Instagram. Deadline is May 18th. Visit iHeartAMDA.com for full rules and details. Visit iHeartAMDA.com today.
What makes TD Bank a you first kind of place? Maybe it's how we're a greet you and your dog by your name kind of place. Because putting people first is how we put you first. That's how TD is making banking unexpectedly human.